Blogging the Boys presents Cowboys Radio with Rabs and McCool. Here are your hosts, Rabble Rouser and Landon McCool.
Hello, howdy, and welcome to another edition of Blogging the Boys Cowboys Radio. I'm Landon McCool, and with me, as always, is Rabble Rouser. Rabble, another week, another L, unfortunately. This is really tough to swallow at this point.
Yeah, mostly what I'm doing right now is and I'm not the only one doing this. There's a whole slate of articles that came out in the day or two after the game that were about, do you appreciate Tony Romo now? and I have to say that that's mostly the state I'm in. I'm really appreciating how good he is and what a difference he makes. That sort of drunken video that came out, what is it, 3 or 4 years ago now, when he dissed on Parcells and then drunkenly proclaimed that Romo was a miracle. He had no idea how accurate that statement was. Not only that they found such a great quarterback, as an undrafted free agent, but just how good he is. You watch the quarterback play here, and we become accustomed to that level of quality, and it's sort of shocking when we don't get it. We forget, I think, how steep the drop off is. Anyway, so quick question: who leads the team in touchdown passes right now?
Well, I happen to know, but it still boggles the mind that the answer, unfortunately, is Tony Romo with three.
With three. Yeah. I know. Isn't that crazy?
Which is just three. I mean, three.
And they all came in the first game, I believe. In the second game,
it was 13-0 when he got hurt.
Their touchdown was the block punt.
That's right. Yeah. So then, yeah, I guess you're right. Wow. That's just unsettling. I mean, really, frankly, it's just unsettling in general when the best news of the day was that, I saw a video of Tony throwing in practice today, mm-hmm. And it's like, that just kind of shows you the state of affairs for Cowboys fans. And there's a lot of different topics that we have to get to on this. But I do think that, all of us are kind of just, shell-shocked, and a certain amount of PTSD has started to set in. And I know that it's just gotten to the point where we're clawing at each other, arguing about all kinds of different aspects, just because it's so – I mean, it is. And I think the thing that makes it even more upsetting, and again, we'll get into this as well, is that, we're watching – we know what it is. Like, it's we're watching the defense, put out consistently – good performances, and in some cases great performances, and just this inability to do anything offensively, and just that hopelessness there, is it's depressing. And I think that there's glimmers of hope, like we said, and we'll get into that with Colin, how Collins played and Dez is back. I mean, he didn't have a great game, obviously, but the idea that he's back in general and that he will hopefully progressively get better with more weeks on the foot. But overall, it has been kind of just mentally and emotionally just exhausting to kind of wade through this. But we are here to help you guys get through all of that. So
we're handing out galoshes, everybody.
Yeah, so with that in mind, what do we have on the show today, Rob?
Well, we're going to do something a little bit different today. Usually what happens is we preview the upcoming game with someone who covers the other team. But first of all, it's Eagles week. And even though Brandon Lee Gouten was really, really nice and very gentlemanly last time he came on, I'm not really interested in talking about the Eagles this week.
And I think
we've got our own problems.
I say this phrase a lot, but if you listen to this podcast, you have a good idea of what the Eagles are and what they're going to do. So, I'm sure we'll cover some Eagles topics for sure. But I think, we know who the Eagles are right now. We don't know who the Cowboys are, frankly. So,
it's more important
to focus on that.
And that's a lovely segue, because one of the interesting things that's happened since the bye is that they seem to be doing some innovating or at least some switching up in terms of the running game. So after sort of 2 weeks of this, we realized that this is actually a trend, not a kind of one game one-off kind of situation. So what we did is we thought we'd be really interesting to talk about it. So we've invited X's and O's super genius Joey Ikes to come in and talk about that. And then we'll have BTB's own Tom Ryle, the estimable Ryle, will drop by the studio to share his thoughts on Sunday's close but no cigar loss to Seattle.
All right. Well, before we move forward, we should obviously talk to about this game. So I guess, you know, one of the obvious interesting things about this game in particular was that it kind of, you know, harkened us back to that glorious Seattle game last season in Seattle, where it was kind of, you know, the if not locally for the Cowboys fans, I would say definitely nationally, you know, league wide, it was kind of a coming out party for the Cowboys to be able to beat a team like Seattle in Seattle, which, you know, is notoriously difficult to beat at home. It was a huge game for the Cowboys' confidence. It was a huge game for the Cowboys fans, you know, and it kind of offered a sort of measuring stick as to where we were. So, keeping that in mind, where do you think we were measured with this year's iteration of the Seattle game?
Well, you know what's interesting? So the Seahawks, as we talked about last week in our podcast when we talked to Spike Friedman, who covers the team, you know, they've been the team against which all NFC teams need to measure themselves because of the reigning two-time NFC champs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, until something happens, you know, the road to the Super Bowl goes through Seattle.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, in some ways, obviously, this year's iteration of the Cowboys was found wanting. You know, the thing that you were just talking about, you know, it was a kind of measuring stick, and we made a kind of national splash with the way the Cowboys played. But the amazing thing about that game was they had all kinds of breaks go against them. You know, yeah. Seattle got like 20 of their 23 points off of turnovers, you know, and short drives and that kind of thing. The Cowboys gave them a bunch of opportunities. And if you take those away, and the Cowboys absolutely, utterly, and completely dominated the game. They went in and at the toughest place to play in the NFL and hit them in the mouth and hit them in the mouth again and dominated them on both lines of scrimmage. It was awesome.
It was.
So, you know, the thing about this, and this goes back to our conversation about Romo, you know, let me ask you this question. Is there any doubt in your mind that the Cowboys win if Romo is the quarterback?
No.
See, that's no. The thing. That's the no. thing.
And in fact, I think it's a blowout, frankly. I mean, if Romo added to that game, it wouldn't have even been close.
No, and we can make all kinds of, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of arguments that are probably fair arguments that can be made that Seattle doesn't play the same game if Romo's there.
That's,
Seattle
I mean,
plays
that's
a different game.
Yeah.
You know, Seattle went in there. I mean, what do you do when you go into the road and you're playing a talented but wounded team? You know, you probably play a little safer, you know, closer to the vest, and you let your all-pro quarterback win at the end. And that's exactly what they did because, you know, their team doesn't have an all-pro quarterback that is capable of doing that. But I do believe that the way that we played, that we win that game pretty easily. Mm-hmm. And, you know, unless there's, you know, some sort of horrible turnover deficiency or something. And so, you know, part of me feels like, oh, wow, we were really weighed and measured and found wanting. But the other part of me says, you know, we lost by, you know, 1 point on the, you know, the last exchange of possessions to the reigning NFC champs. And so, you know, this team is still pretty good. Now, you know, this brings me back to something that a lot of different pundits have been talking about this week, which is the fact that Jason Garrett and his coaching staff have, quote unquote, gone conservative. You know, and so I think one of the things that we saw in, you know, all the 8-8 seasons, there were too many times where people talked about the team being too conservative. And I said again and again, this, you know, yes, they're conservative because they're undermanned and they know it. And so if you have the best kicker in the game and you have a quarterback who can do the kind of stuff at the end of the game that Romo can, the best strategy every week is not to open it up early and try to get a big lead. It's to do everything you can to protect that quarterback so he's there at the end and even more importantly there at the end of the season. And then you try to give it to him, his tight end, his, you know, his all universe wide receiver, and ultimately the best kicker in the game to try to win that game. And they did that again and again and again in those years. You know, they would keep a game close, whether it was to a better team or their, you know, or not. But oftentimes with teams that were probably better. They would keep the game close, and you know, the prayer was always, let's see if we can, you know, turn it over to Dan Bailey at the end and scratch out a drive. And this is the way you have to win when you're outmanned. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody wants them to start throwing the ball around. And, you know, a couple of people who are a little bit more sane have been like, okay, great. But you realize that the chances then of being down 21-0 with Matt Cassel at the helm are pretty high. And while you might be down 21-0 with Tony Romo at the helm and have a chance, if you're down 21-0 with one of these backups at the helm, you're done. And so you could be done 10 minutes into the game. Uh-huh. So do you want to be done 10 minutes into the game just for the sake of, you know, flinging it around? Or do you want to try to have your best chance to win at the end? And I think that, yes, they're conservative. They've been conservative ever since Romo went down. But I believe that conservatism is – you know, we can argue about whether it gives them the best chance to win. It gives them the best chance to have relevant fourth quarters, and it gives them the best chance not to be blown out early in the game, so they have no chance of winning.
I just think it's silly. I mean, honestly, like, I mean, I understand like the argument that people are making, but you know, listen, I mean, you have to look at the personnel that being deployed out there, and then beyond all that, I mean, all the points you just made are all right on, and then in addition to that, I would challenge people to go back and watch the last three games. Darren McFadden threw a pass on Sunday.
Right.
You know,
right.
I mean, we're running reverses to Lucky Whitehead that we never would have run before. I could be wrong, but didn't we run a double reverse the other day? Like, I mean, I think it was two games ago. It just seems like, you know, they're pulling out stops to try to win the game. It's not like they aren't, you know, taking chances at all. They are taking chances. It's just that, you know, I think people view the downfield passing game as you know, not conservative. I don't really want to call it liberal play calling, but you know, I'm saying like it's you know, dangerous play calling is throwing down the field. I don't know that that's necessarily the truth, and I don't know that that's necessarily not what's happening on the play caller side. I think that's the other part that's being forgotten. All this is that, you know, I mean, people complained about Romo and Garrett running a conservative game plan, but we got the ball down the field without any problem. I think the issue is not a conservative game plan or a conservative game call. I think the problem is that it's being executed safely, because the line one for the quarterbacks is exactly what you're talking about: protect the ball and try to keep the game as close as possible. And I think, you know, and this kind of leads us into our kind of next topic, which is, you know, Matt Cassel had a Whedon-esque kind of game.
He sure did.
People have been saying this kind of thing and Whedon-esque and all that, but honestly, like, I think the common denominator here is that the Cowboys have determined that whether it be with Cassel or whether it be with Whedon, that the best way for them to win these games, and again, I don't think that this is a multi-game or a generalized strategy, but I also think you have to, you know, look at who you're playing. But I think that the Cowboys' strategy for a lot of these games was to not let their own quarterback beat them, you know, and not let the mistakes and turnovers beat them and get down by multiple touchdowns where they have no chance, like you said, to come back. And I think a lot of this is a confluence of events too. I think, you know, people forget that these last few games have come against some really, really strong opponents. I mean, mm-hmm. Look at how many Super Bowl winning quarterbacks we faced in the last 5 weeks. It's, you know, I think for there to be this expectation that, you know, that there are, and we've talked about this before too, that there are a bunch of different paths to victory with Matt Cassel at quarterback is just ridiculous. There's probably only four ways that you're going to have your backup quarterback and beat a team that was in the Super Bowl last season, that was a yard away from being the Super Bowl champs. There's probably only two or three ways to win that game. Just like 3 weeks ago, there was probably only two or three ways to win that game against the actual Super Bowl champs. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that people want to complain about, you know, the conservative play call and all that stuff, but the truth of the matter is, in all of them except for the Patriots game, really, we've been in the game until the end, or at least close to the end, which is, when you lose, about all that you can ask. You know, it's the fact is that they provided the coaching you know, a game call, I think, provided them – they didn't take necessary risks. Sometimes maybe people could say, oh, they probably should have gone for a touchdown when they went for a field goal. But the point is that the team took points when they were able to get points and were still there at the end. And then, you know, it again came down to them not making those last few plays to make a play at the end to win the game. And you know, it's not a game plan that's fun to watch if you're a Cowboys fan and you're used to Tony Romo drawing it up in the dirt and – you know, flinging it around, but it was the game plan that I think they thought gave them the highest probability of winning against a defense that wants you to have to drive down the field methodically in order to score.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think the confluence of the defense they're playing, the talent level they're up against, and the fact that they have a backup quarterback all added up to what you saw on Sunday. And, you know, they just didn't make enough plays offensively to win the game.
No, and you know, the other thing I'm hearing, and this goes with the conversation we're having, is that the Cowboys' offensive brain trust needs to be more quote unquote creative, and you know, I'm like, what play do you, like, what's the creative play that's going to work? You know, is this the play where Devin Street suddenly plays like Dez Bryant? Is that the creative play?
Are we going to run the wildcat?
Is it the play where you line up and you go for 11? Like, what's the play? You know, what's this special play? Because you know that stuff might work in Pop Warner, but you know, the more advanced levels of the more you advance through the various levels of football, the more that kind of stuff doesn't work, and you just have to have sound schemes, and you win with elite players who win matchups, and yeah. They don't have those players. Don't have those players.
And unfortunately, they got one of those guys back this week, and you know, it's tough for me to determine. I've gone back and watched a couple times, and I think there's three elements to why Dez didn't have a huge game. One was he's coming off of serious foot injury rather early. Two, he was playing against Richard Sherman, who is considered to be one of the top corners in the league and, frankly, is playing at the top of his game, maybe playing as well as he's ever played right now. And three, you know, again, Matt Castle's the one throwing him the ball. Mm-hmm. And so I think when you have only one true guy who can create plays on his own on your offense, being Dez Bryant, you know, I think Witten is not – a playmaker at this stage in his career, as much as he will get open on third down and catch the ball. But without Dez Bryant drawing coverage from him, you know, he gets double teams and he's not an option, you know, and the same thing with Beasley. So neither one of those two, you know, I thought that Beasley would be able to create more just because he is kind of a mismatch player. But again, they still were focusing a lot of attention on him, and Beasley wasn't winning a lot of one-on-ones. And again, we'll get into the running back situation as well, but the current situation with the running game, even though there was a lot of yards, the not Seattle game, but the previous game, I don't know that the run game is in such a state that it can be carrying the offense either. You know, I think the Seattle did a good job of making it look pedestrian again. And I think, you know, it's just, there's too many factors working against an offense that doesn't have anybody on it that's completely healthy that can overcome all of the negatives that it's working uphill against.
So let me ask you a question. Why do teams have training camp?
Well, yeah. I mean, teams have training camp to properly install and the schemes and make sure that the players fit those schemes and then determine – well, maybe this player needs a bigger role, and all the elements that go into deciding, hey, how is our offense going to work in season? Mm-hmm. And then obviously the training element of getting them in shape. I think those are, you know, those key roles. And then obviously determining who's on the team. That's obviously another part of it.
So I mean, for individual players then, I mean, you just sort of talked about it, a little thumbnail here. For individual players, it's learning the scheme, it's getting in shape, yes. it's developing a sort of synchronicity. Like for, let's say, for quarterbacks and receivers, it's developing a kind of synchronicity and timing with the other person who you have to have that with. When's the last time Dez Bryant played a meaningful game? Well, I mean, I guess you could say the season opener, but other than that, when's the last time you played a meaningful game, or even played a game?
Green Bay.
Yeah, and so, you know, if we can accept that players, even players of Dez Bryant's caliber, need time with their quarterback and, you know, to develop that kind of you know, that sort of language, that sort of automatic rote language with the other player, and also need to get in shape so they can be at the top of their game. He missed all of training camp. Mm-hmm. He played less than a half, and then he hasn't played since. You know, so the question then becomes, how long should we rightly expect it to take for him to get back into shape? And is it unfair to say it's going to take 6 weeks?
I don't think it'll take 6 weeks.
Just, 4 weeks? How long does this take? Because, I mean, he can't have been running for that long.
Are we talking about 100%? Because I think, yeah, maybe 3 or 4 weeks before he's, you know, back to where he was at this point last season. You know what I'm saying? Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, so how much longer before Dez Bryant is in the same kind of physical condition and is able to do the things he did in Green Bay? And I, you know, obviously we don't know the answer.
We don't
have
an answer, yeah.
But I don't think that, I mean, I think it's asinine to assume that that's going to happen this week or that it was going to happen last week. I mean, the man has to play his way into shape in myriad different ways. Uh-huh. And so, you know, there's a good chance that he won't be at 100% by the time Romo comes back. So then we need to apply the same question to Romo. How long does it take a quarterback to get back into shape, to get his arm back into shape, to get his timing down?
I think I could make the argument that Romo would come back fast, much, much faster than Dez would.
Let me bring up something that happened last year. Remember last year during the 49ers opener? What was the thing that Romo admitted that led to all those interceptions? That this, he wasn't ready for the speed of the game, like he hadn't seen enough preseason action. Right? He admitted it. You know, you can do a lot of mental reps, but you need to actually take those physical reps so you can get your processor speed back up. And so I don't know why that wouldn't apply when he comes back this year. So my larger point in asking these questions is that I think one of the things that we all assume is that Dez comes back, boom, he's Dez from the playoff run. Romo comes back, boom, he's Romo from the last month of the season in the playoff run. And we may not see those guys until the second week in December.
Yeah, and that I think that's a realistic expectation. But what I also think is that honestly, Romo at a slower processor speed. Now, San Francisco is one thing. I mean, playing at that level would not be great, but I think Romo should come back at a level that should at least help us win these games, or at least help us win a couple games until he's back, you know, fully up to speed, just because I think of the state of our defense. You know,
yeah,
I mean,
no question.
I think if our defense can continue to keep us in games, Romo can eke out better performances than these guys. You know what I'm saying? And not that anyone's suggesting that Romo doesn't start when he comes back, but my point is that I think it's even with that in mind, I think it's an automatic upgrade from where we are currently. Now, I think you have a solid point, because I think Dez may take some easing back into getting to where he is 100%. But I also think he can be effective still, you know, I mean, at least in some ways. So it is an interesting question. And I know that we all were hoping that obviously that they'd come back and be 9-88 as soon as they hit the ground, and they'd hit the ground running. But it is a good question to ask and a proper expectation, I think, to set for these guys.
You know, and so we've got a resurgent Miami team, and we've got a Carolina team who is just, you know, looks like a tough team that's been beating all comers. And the Miami game's on the road. So I think the expectations of Cowboys Nation is, if we can eke out one or two wins now, we set the table so that the games can, you know, so that when Romo and Dez come back, we can start winning again. And I guess the thing I want everyone to just think about, not that this is going to happen, or not that this should be, you know, more fodder for your season-long depression, but that, is it fair to those two players for us to say, oh, right, they're just going to be back, and that they're not going to struggle mightily against a really good Miami defense and a really good Carolina defense, and that might, you know, that their return might not be enough against those teams, because those are also really, really good teams. So it's just stuff to think about as we begin to, you know, as we continue to negotiate the funk that we talked about at the beginning of our conversation.
Yeah, and that definitely is something to, you know, to incorporate when properly calibrating their expectations, for sure. Okay, well, a couple more things before we move on to Joey, but I want to obviously talk about the defensive performances the last 2 weeks, especially, you know, have really that this defense has really started to come on. You know, not everyone was playing perfect, but I mean, you hold two teams to less than 20 points. Oh, wait, 20 points, right? Well, how much did?
Well, 13 for each, because if you think about, two of the touchdowns that New York got were on returns.
Yeah, that's right. So whenever you hold two teams back to back, you know, to under two touchdowns, you know, both of which are Super Bowl winning, multiple Super Bowl attending Super Bowl winning quarterbacks. That's pretty good. That's pretty good defensive performance, and you know, again, kind of even makes the fact that you lose those games even more, you know, sour. So what? I mean, I guess my question is, you know, how, if you're the defense, what, I mean, do you think this is affecting the locker room at all at this point? I mean, you know, between the offense and the defense, because at this point, it just seems like, you know, this defense is churning out pretty spectacular performances, and they're looking across the other side of the room and just saying, guys, what's going on?
Well, you know, I think it might be if you had either A, a weaker locker room, and B, a starting quarterback. I mean, they know. You know, they play against these guys. They understand how good Tony is. They know that for years they would give him 27 and Tony would give him 28, you know? And so, I mean, I think they understand that, you know, last week was a little tough. You know, I think that, but in some ways what they need to do is they need to give up 13, but they also need to score 7.
Yeah.
You know, or contribute mightily to 7. And I think that nothing illustrates that more than the Greg Hardy play, where if he didn't get tripped up by Russell Wilson, they probably win the game. Or at least they have a better chance of winning the game. And, you know, but the offense did nothing with the ball after Hardy set them up. And if he wasn't in the red zone, they were darn near the red zone at the point where they took possession. So I think the defensive performance certainly gives us hope. But, you know, the thing about the Cowboys when they got on a roll in December, and I've talked about this a couple times, when they got on a roll in December, they played really well on all three phases. But the other thing that they did is they got a tremendous amount of takeaways. You know, they had in the last month of the season something like 12 or 13 takeaways. And so those takeaways both obviously stop drives, but they also translate into points. And until they start getting takeaways, you know, a 13-point defensive performance has a kind of limited impressive quality to it, because I think the really dominant defenses don't give up points late, and they've been giving up points late, and they don't allow takeaways, or rather they generate takeaways all the time. And you know, one takeaway in every game this year, other than the Philadelphia game, it still isn't doing it. They're not, you know, I think that their performance is good, and it's good enough to win, but in many ways, one could make an argument that the 2014 team played better defense in December because they kept getting the ball, taking it away, and giving it to the offense for more points. And look at the scores. You know, look at those scores. Yeah. They averaged almost 40 points a game in those last four games because they just kept siphoning them the ball.
Now I have to ask, because this is something that I've been thinking about a lot lately. Do you think that it could be possible that, and I know statistically not all of it, because we are on a kind of a, they were on a legendary kind of streak of no turnovers, but I'm starting to wonder, and I don't want to just place all problems on the offense, but I am starting to wonder if some of the lack of turnovers has to do with the fact that these teams come into the game and base their offensive game plan on not, you know, being smart with the ball and not having to take chances, because this offense isn't going to make them.
Well, you know? this goes back to the conversation we had earlier about Seattle, you know, might have played a very different game had Tony Romo been in the
lineup.
Exactly.
I think that's maybe what I'm saying is that it's, you know, when you have Tony Romo and you have Dez Bryant on the other side of the field and you're an offense, you're thinking to yourself, well, I mean, I got to help my defense out. I got to, you know, score points in order to do that. And that pressing combined with, you know, the defensive technique that, you know, stripping and all that, I think, you know, contributes to the number of turnovers. And I think if you're playing Dallas now and you see Matt Cassel and Darren McFadden across the way, and Terrence Williams, or I guess now a hobbled Dez Bryant, as your number one receiving threat, there's no reason to press, right? So it's more of, hey, let's control the ball. Let's score, obviously, but let's not do anything too drastic. And if there's a point in the game where you feel like you need to take a chance in order to convert a third down or score or whatever, don't do it. You know, just take the sack, live to fight another day, because eventually our talent and the QB differential will win out.
Yeah, and you know, there's lots of studies on turnovers. You know, and you know this stuff very well. Like, the fumbles are pretty much a random occurrence.
Yes,
and fumble recoveries are a particularly random occurrence. But the interceptions do happen. You know, they're less luck driven, mm-hmm. And because of that, they tend to happen when quarterbacks are under duress, and that happens, and when they're passing more often, and that tends to happen late in games. You know, I mean, there's a reason that Tony Romo threw very few interceptions last year. It's because he wasn't being asked to pass in the fourth quarter very many games. Whereas there's a reason that they kept building leads in the fourth quarter. It's because the other teams were, and they were passing more, and they were throwing more interceptions. So one of the other things that's not happening is that they're not. The opposing teams, by keeping it close, are not putting their quarterbacks into situations in which they must pass late in the game to tie the game, to get it close when they're down by 10, or there's 2 minutes left, they're down by a touchdown, or whatever. Those kinds of situations in which you know they have to pass. When's the last time the opposition was in one of those situations? Maybe the end of the first half in the Atlanta game. I mean, it's been a long time.
It's been a while.
You know, it's been quite a while, and so. This team isn't good enough to put the opposition into those kind of turnover prone type of situations. Now that's part one. And part two of this is that, and this is something that nobody really wants to kind of come to terms with, but the bottom line is football is a really luck driven sport.
Yes.
And the luck extends to a lot of different aspects of the equation. Right,
yes.
Everything from injuries to, you know, when fumbles happen and who recovers them. You know, last year at the beginning of the season, everyone's like, "Oh, DeMarco Murray is fumble prone." Oh, you know, I mean, he might have had one fumble that was actually, you know, had to do with the fact that he was being slightly careless with the ball. The other one, like, you know, Devin Street's elbow hits his ball, rather hits the ball out, you know, at the end of a long run. There's another one where he's in a pile and someone's shoe hits it. I mean, you know, these are random occurrences that happen when there's a bunch of people. Going full speed at each other, and so that side of it, the Cowboys have been an incredibly unlucky team this year. They were a very, very lucky team last year, and that luck has just all dried up. So you can call it a regression to the mean if you want. OCC, you know, might be proud of us if we in fact do call it that. But for whatever you want to call it. The football gods have kind of evened things out, and I think we all want to believe that the better team wins. And the truth of the matter is, in the NFL, the better team doesn't always win, and oftentimes it's a really lucky thing. Whether that's a official's call, whether that's a fumble, whether that's a guy gets a part of a foot out of bounds, you know, an opportune penalty at a moment. I mean, these things all sort of happen, and the best teams. Manage to build leads big enough so that those kind of things
don't. Doesn't happen. So you don't have to worry about luck in order to win a game. You're a good enough team that you take luck out of the equation. And
banish Lady Luck from the stadium. So let's imagine the Romo plays and the Cowboys have a 20-point lead when Jeff Heath blocks that guy or whatever, you know, and the guy gets knocked out and there's a penalty. Does the penalty matter? The penalty doesn't even matter. I mean, you know, we're still talking about the play, but the penalty doesn't matter. Or even that 12 men on the field call, which is a much better example, frankly. The officials clearly blew it, mm-hmm. and it might have cost the Cowboys points. Of course, we're all assuming that they would have, after the first down, driven for a touchdown, which is, I think, a pretty bold assumption. Fallacy of the assumed hit, exactly.
Yeah, I agree.
But we're talking about that because that could have provided the difference, right? We're talking about the sort of phantom downfield block call on Devin Street because that could have provided the difference in the Giants game. You know, there were these little random plays suddenly mean something when you're in these games that are decided at the end of the game, that are decided by a touchdown or less, et cetera. And last year's team continued to banish Lady Luck from the stadium by building these gigantic leads. You know, the combination of the fact that they're not good enough to build these leads, so the games are all close for the most part, except the Patriots game, and that combined with the fact that they've been pretty unlucky this year for the most part in all these different things, have combined to make this a particularly difficult season.
Yes. I totally agree. And keeping it with that, we do have to finally move on to, speaking of difficult seasons, have to finally move on to the very recent and still very fresh Joe Randall situation. Well, I'd like to hear your take first, I think, if you have one.
You know, I don't really have one because I think that – so a couple things. I don't think it was any – one thing that happened last week that got him kicked off the team.
I agree.
I believe that this is a kind of straw on camel's back situation in which a long history of peculiar behaviors, of not listening to coaches as much as they would prefer, et cetera, finally just got to be where, you know what, it's not worth it anymore.
Yeah.
That said, it seems like there was also some kind of breaking point like Steven and Jerry are referring to when they say he needs to go take care of his own business, his own mental health, that kind of thing. And it's all very cryptic. And I suppose at some point what he's going through is actually going to come out.
Yeah. I feel like there's missing information.
I agree. And so it's very difficult to have an opinion about it because I don't know what that missing information is. So what are you thinking?
Well, I mean, that's kind of one of the things I wanted to point out. And I thought it was, you know, I saw a whole bunch of people – you know, kind of wringing their hands over Joe Randall. And I thought that was just really classless because we don't really know what happened with Joe Randall. And I understand that, you know, people don't like his history and what happened. And obviously a lot of it is kind of inexcusable, but I also think just, and maybe I'm doing this and I shouldn't be, but just reading the tea leaves of the way things were reported about him makes me think that there's something going on here with his reaction to a lot of this stuff that maybe triggered something in, okay, maybe he's dealing with some like mental health issues. Maybe like it's not just that he's I think everyone's calling him a knucklehead and all this stuff. And I have a feeling that, you know, all this other stuff, you know, like, and I'm not going to get into the particulars of it, but the whole thing with him calling the police because he found his girlfriend's phone in his car, and it's like it's that kind of like reaction to stuff that I just wonder if there might be, you know, something going on with him that they just like, look, it's just one thing too much. And really, this is not even what I kind of wanted to discuss about this. What I kind of wanted to discuss was how and this kind of will bleed into or will segue hopefully into Joey's whole thing is, you know, how unfortunate the whole situation ended up being for him, you know, because I think you look at the game that, you know, some people are pointing to as Darren McFadden's breakout game, like the guy hadn't been in the league for 7 years. And you know, Randall had two carries early for 20 yards or something like that. Like he was running like a madman too behind that line. And then he injures, you know, re-injures his oblique, and you know, I just think that combined with all the other stuff that happened the rest of that week with what we just described, and then him being benched, and then probably his reaction to that, all just kind of created a terrible perfect storm for him, and obviously it led to him being released. But I think there's this common misconception, and this is the part that I want to kind of debunk, at least in my mind, that McFadden made Randall expendable, you know, that McFadden has just been this, you know, revelation to the run game, and all our problems are solved and we don't need Randall anymore. Like, no, cutting Randall, it was terrible. I mean, not it wasn't a terrible decision, but the fact that we have to get rid of him is not good for this team. Right. We're not, you know, Garrett comes out and says we're set at running back, but you wouldn't rather have a mentally stable Joe Randall in this running back crew. Of course you would, you know, I think this whole idea that it's OK now and the run game's OK, like completely ignores the evidence to the contrary. You know, I think what McFadden could do is get the yards that are there for him. And I don't know that he's going to get much else than that, you know? And the good news about that is that we have an offensive line that can create some yards. And the other good news about that is that the offense you know, seems to have morphed a little bit to kind of fit McFadden, because they've realized that he may be the, you know, the only thing that they've got, it's, you know, from here on out.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it's you know, I think that some people are suggesting that this is like a, you know, a positive development, that, you know, McFadden has grabbed the running back position by the throat, and I don't view it like that at all. Yeah, I think unfortunately they're stuck in a situation where they don't still completely trust Christine Michael, and Rod Smith literally got time on the field last week because he had to, because we only had, you know, two other running backs.
Mm-hmm.
So I just think that the Randall situation is sad for him personally, sad for the Cowboys because it didn't obviously work out the way that they had planned, but also scary because I, you know, there is very, very, not that there was a ton of certainty before, but there's very little certainty now at the running back position. So if something were to happen, you know, we could be in quite a bad situation very quickly.
Hey, the four running backs, and I'm not the first person to point this out, the four running backs that were getting the most press as we head into training camp, there's only one of them standing right now.
Yeah. And that's not a good thing at all. It's not because of fantastic performances have bumped them off the radar. But, okay, this is obviously the best part for us to bring Joey in. And before we do, I want to make sure that we plug Blogging the Boys. BloggingTheBoys.com is the one spot for all your information for Cowboys-related info. Make sure that you're checking them out for updates on Romo as he's starting to hopefully make his way back. You know, all the updates on – it's Eagles week. So it's a great time to be on Blogging the Boys because commentators are going to be riled up, and there's obviously lots of topics to discuss. So make sure you're checking out BloggingTheBoys.com. Check out their Facebook, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys.
Ah, buckaroos. Scamp walker time again. Yeah, I'm trying to slide one by you once more. Don't matter how you do it. They say, just do it like you know it. And I've been down this road once or twice before.
We are joined once again by the great Joey Ikes. Joey, thanks for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Hey, I appreciate it, guys. Glad to be here as always.
So, Joey, as you all probably well know, is the Wizard of the Whiteboard. And he happens to be our podcast's resident X's O's expert, and we mean expert. I've said it 1,000 times, although I'm going to add a little bit to this now. My dream football weekend includes going to a bowl game, a Cowboys playoff win, and an afternoon somewhere in there with Joey on the whiteboard. And I'm actually lucky enough to be getting a distilled version of that every Wednesday in a Google Hangout that Joey and Landon and I have scheduled, during which we chat and watch all 22 footage of the most recent game. It's great, great stuff. And I always learn something about the Cowboys that nobody else is talking about or probably even notices, frankly. So we're thrilled to have Joey here to share his knowledge. Thank you, sir, for joining us.
You are far too kind, and it is my pleasure as always.
So this conversation that I want to have actually began with an email that I sent to you after the second Giants game, which I was looking for confirmation of something that I had noticed, which was that the Cowboys seemed to have changed the distribution of play calls in the running game in terms of the types of runs they were dialing up and how often they were dialing them up. So as a way to get into that, and what that all might mean, I think it's best to begin by going over the various types of runs that we'll be discussing. So if you could just quickly give everyone a kind of sense of what it means we talk about or when we use these terms. So let's start with outside zone. What does outside zone mean? What is that all about?
Well, the outside zone is the old school stretch run play. You hear the commentators use the word stretch when they talk about that play. It's the old Denver Broncos, Mike Shanahan, Alex Gibbs, Gary Kubiak, stretch run play. Everybody, all the linemen get their guys moving horizontally one way or the other. The running back gets the ball going at a 45-degree angle, kind of almost parallel to the line of scrimmage at times. And he has a couple of reads that he makes, which tell him which hole is going to be open. And he takes that and makes that read, executes it, and gets up the field either outside between the guard and the tackle, or kind of straight up the field next to, right behind the center.
And then, so by comparison, what is the inside zone?
So the inside zone is pretty similar, other than the fact that it's executed more north and south. So mm-hmm. on the outside zone, the aiming point for the running back is kind of the right butt cheek of the tight end, if there's a tight end on that side, or the imaginary tight end, if there's not a tight end to that side. So then on the inside zone, the aiming point becomes the middle of the back of the offensive guard on the play side. So if it's inside zone right, you're aiming for the back of the right offensive guard.
So you're basically going between the 7 and the 0 of Zach Martin.
yeah, basically. So on outside zone, you're reading the last defender on the line of scrimmage onto the play side. Mm-hmm. On the inside zone, it's the opposite. You're reading the first defender on the play side, but a nose technique or a one technique, like we talk about Nick Hayden plays in Dallas, doesn't count. So you don't count the guy over the center. So you read the next guy to the outside, usually a defensive tackle, like a 3 technique or maybe a 5 technique if you're talking about a 3-4 team. And you're reading him. If he goes outside, you go inside. If he goes inside, you go outside. So it's designed, the zone run plays are designed to make a defense wrong no matter what they do, basically. So it sets up to allow linemen to get to the second level and block linebackers who are trying. And there's a ton of minuscule detail that you could get into, but overall, I think that kind of gives a pretty good understanding of the way it works.
And then the last set of terms, I guess, is man and or man power.
Right. So the zone schemes are pretty kind of universal. There's some variation, but they're pretty universal. When you start talking about man schemes or gap schemes mm-hmm. or trap schemes, or there's all these other types of runs that you can execute. And the most common is probably the power play, where you pull the guard from the backside, bring him around to the front side, give yourselves a numbers advantage. Everybody blocks a man. The guard usually leads up through the hole and away you go. But then there's also all the sweeps where you pull guys. Those are all kind of the same kind of concept of using those guys. And the difference is that it allows the running back to, rather than having to make the multiple step read and just go and trust the scheme, those kind of runs allow him to use instinct a little more, get downhill immediately, and then read off the blocks of the guys that are going once you kind of get into the hole. So that's the difference between the gap scheme. The gap scheme takes a little bit less lateral agility, because rather than putting your foot in the ground and making that hard upfield cut like we see so often from guys like Arian Foster in the past and Terrell Davis back in the day, guys like that, rather than seeing that, you're seeing small 20 degree angle cuts around blocks to avoid defenders and stuff like that. So that's probably the primary difference, is the level of lateral agility required from a running back.
So that's all fantastic info, and that was, again, very, very simply described, so we appreciate that. So the next question is, how has the Cowboys running game changed since the bye week, and what are they doing differently than they were in games 1-5?
Well, the thing that I think, to get the real accurate description and get the context right, you almost have to go back even further and go back to 2014. Mm-hmm. And this is kind of the context of what your email to me was about. And that was that with DeMarco Murray as the running back, they were a pretty even split in their run game. They ran probably about 40 to 50% outside zone, and then a significant amount of inside zone. And then they had a pretty significant amount of these gap power kind of pull linemen, trap guys kind of plays that they would run. And then this year they come in a different type of running back. Joseph Randall is more of a lateral athlete than DeMarco Murray, who's more of a kind of get downhill and go and lean into guys kind of runner. So they were at 70 to 80% outside zone in the first 5 games. So they were extremely primary outside zone, wanting to get Joseph Randle the opportunity to the simplistic way to say it is pick a gap and go, but that's not exactly the way it works. But that's kind of the easier way to say it is to allow Joseph Randle the opportunity for there to be one of multiple holes open and allow him to make the play, use his lateral agility and get up the field. After the bye, I said something kind of the way that I worded it following the Giants game was that the Cowboys on offense, it seemed like Scott Linehan took a note from Rod Marinelli from the Patriots game right before the bye. And that was the willingness to deviate from your identity in almost every way. And suddenly after the bye week, and we never know what their intention was for the Giants game, because Joseph Randle goes 2 carries for 24 yards, hurts an oblique muscle, and Darren McFadden takes 90% of the carries for the rest of the game. And in those carries, they were a significant majority of gap, angle, trap type schemes where you're pulling offensive linemen all over the place and using those guys as the opportunity to set the hole for McFadden to run through. And I've said a few times that McFadden's the kind of guy who kind of needs a runway to get going and before he can make a guy miss or run through a tackle or anything like that. And I've said several times that if you run a ton of gap and a ton of sweeps and things like that, you could be just fine running Darren McFadden out there for 15 carries a game as your lead back in a committee. But they weren't that kind of a team until the Giants game. And they came out and did that, were able to run the ball successfully with it, and then came out and did it again against the Seahawks and had some success with it, but not nearly as much as they did against the Giants.
So this leads me to my next question, and this is what I'm wondering. So is this indicating a general philosophical shift, or do you think it's really a matter of catering the running game to the particular backs they have? I ask this because, as you've just articulated, it seems like these changes very neatly coincide with Darren McFadden, as you just sort of said, assuming the chairmanship of the running back by committee.
Yeah, and it's one of the things, I mean, and we talked about this in our Wednesday stuff for a couple of weeks right after the Patriots game, was Corey White playing in the slot a game plan thing specific for the Patriots to kind of go against what they had done the rest of the year in order to catch the Patriots kind of off guard, give them a different matchup, or was it something that they wanted to do going forward? And we weren't able to find that out until the next week when they played the Giants and Tyler Patman was inactive and it was Corey White playing the slot. And then it was, well, Byron Jones has been playing a lot. He's been playing some safety. Does he eventually become the starter? And we weren't able to find that out until the next week when Byron Jones played 100% of the defensive snaps and a lot of them were at safety. So it's difficult to ascertain until something changes the status quo. Right. And I'll knock on wood because nobody wants it to happen. But I think the elephant in the room that we all know and understand is that at some point, Darren McFadden is going to get hurt.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so until something like that happens, where they go to a different style of runner, and they go to whether it's Christian Michael who becomes the lead guy, or Rod Smith, or Trey Williams, or whoever becomes the lead guy at that point, if they go back to more zone stuff, if they go back to the stretch, the outside zone or the wide zone, then we know that it was catering to McFadden. If they don't, then it's something that they believe that their offensive line could execute better based on the size and the athleticism that they possess on the offensive line. So we won't know until the status quo changes, and that might be a cop-out answer, but it's really impossible to know without sitting down with Scott Linehan or Frank Pollock or somebody like that and picking their brain on what their thinking was.
And unfortunately, the ideal test case is Joe Randle. Right. Exactly. So if Joe Randall came back and they were running a lot more like, you know, power, then we'd say, OK, obviously philosophical shift. But we'll never know because he's not coming back.
The other thing, too, that kind of muddies the water here a little bit, or at least it did Sunday, is that I have to think that it is a much more beneficial game plan against specifically Seattle to probably run some more power schemes because they're such a speed based defense that they can, you know, over pursue and then bottle the running back up. The thing that kills the outside zone game, and Joey, obviously you can attest to this more than anything, is when you muddy the reads for the running backs and when they are forced to hesitate. And this was our problem a lot with Murray when he was running it last year, is when you muddy the reads and the running back is behind the line of scrimmage and starts shuffling his feet, it's easy for the backside pursuit, if they can get, you know, good angle or some penetration, to catch up with the running back and tackle him for a loss, or at least hit him and, you know, disrupt the blocking scheme momentarily. So I wonder if, you know, obviously I can all agree that McFadden runs better in a power or a gap schemes, but I do also wonder if, you know, that whole thing was kind of dovetailed nicely for Linehan, that, oh, well, I have McFadden as my lead back, but also on top of that, I probably want to run a little bit more power just because of who we're playing this week.
Yeah, and the other thing that they showed a lot starting with the Giants game and continued to show it was something that I've been asking for 5 weeks, and that was something to threaten the backside.
Yes.
On in the run game, and that was, they began doing that with Lucky Whitehead running across the formation at full speed on that jet motion. And
that was the biggest issue with the outside zone before
exactly,
the first weeks, was keeping back on the backside, and they were just pursuing hard down the line on the backside.
Exactly.
Those reach blocks weren't getting there.
Exactly. And you talked about the muddying the read for the running back. And the thing that the running backs are taught, at least traditionally in most editions of the zone scheme that I'm aware of and the clinic talks that I've heard of, they're taught that if the read is muddy, you stick your foot in the ground and you get north and south.
Yeah.
Because the primary objective, and you guys have talked about this, the primary objective of that blocking system is to avoid negative run plays.
Exactly.
Because you trust the scheme and you trust the players in the scheme well enough to assume that if you get 0 yards this time, you might get 4 or 5 yards next time. So as long as you avoid second and 13, you can run the ball again on second down and be in third and 5 or 6 if you get a 0 yard gain on first down. So if they muddy the read and the running back stops his feet or dances in the hole, kind of like you were talking about, as opposed to sticking his feet in the ground and getting north and south, then that's when, like you said, it gets in trouble.
Okay. So how does this work with the offensive line's relative strengths and weaknesses? Are we seeing more calls that play to their strengths, or is this only about the running backs at this point?
I think that Scott Linehan, Frank Pollock, and those guys, they understand the luxury that they're working with at this point with the offensive line that the Cowboys are playing with. And that is that traditionally a zone blocking scheme offensive line is full of smaller, more athletic offensive linemen who are able to execute the reach blocks and things like that. They don't have to be big because they're not manning up on guys and trying to get a bunch of push. All they have to do is be athletic enough to get their heads across, make those reach blocks, and leave the lanes for the running back to run through. So they have the athletes to be able to execute that. But they're not playing with a bunch of 280-pound offensive linemen.
Mm-hmm.
They're playing with guys that are 3'10", 3'15".
Which is amazing.
That have the level of athleticism that you're talking about guys playing at 280 mm-hmm. and playing with. And part of it's because they've got 4 offensive tackles playing on their offensive line.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way that it is. So they've got the athletes at the guard positions. We know the level of athlete that Tyron Smith is. I think Travis Frederick has surprised just about all of us in the level of that functional athleticism that he has shown as an offensive lineman, pulling and running the zone stuff and all that kind of stuff, getting to the second level. So I think that the offensive line is is one of those rare occasions where they really are almost scheme agnostic. And by that, I mean, it doesn't matter whether they're a zone team or a gap team or an ISO team or any of that kind of stuff. They have the size and the strength to execute the gap plays and the lead plays and things like that, but they have the athleticism to execute the pulls and all that. Because normally on a gap team, you've got four really big offensive linemen, mm-hmm. and then your left guard is a little bit smaller and more athletic because
Kyle
traditionally, mm-hmm. exactly, because traditionally you're running to the right. So if you're running power right, you're pulling your left guard around, and there you go. And so you're pulling your athletic lineman around, and he's leading up to the second level on linebackers, and then away you go. So they happen to be lucky enough to have those athletes all along the line that they can pull, where on any particular play, they can pull a center and a guard. They can pull two guards. They can pull a guard and a tackle. They can pull a center and a tackle. they can really, when it comes to deciding who they're going to pull or scheming these run plays, they really have a ton of flexibility in what they can do and when they can do it.
So, you know, a little earlier you mentioned, you know, the Cowboys offensive brain trust, and it certainly seems, as you've been suggesting, that they spent the bye week as, you know, as all teams do, right, which is sort of pulling back, doing some self-scouting, et cetera. And it seems, you know, for reasons that will remain a mystery to us, but it seems like they realized they needed to distribute these run calls a little differently. I guess what I'm asking you to do here is to read the tea leaves for what they're worth and to try to give some credit where credit is due. So who do you think actually gets credit for this kind of, let's call it a philosophical shift?
Whew. That's rough. I mean, it probably lies somewhere in the trio of the head coach, the offensive coordinator, and the offensive line coach. Because typically the offensive line coach has a pretty big say in the schemes that you're running from a running game perspective. I mean, a lot of times this team has had a passing game coordinator and a running game coordinator, and the running game coordinator happened to be the offensive line coach. So, that's pretty typical from my understanding of the structure of an NFL coaching staff for that offensive line coach to have a big say in the types of run schemes they're running. Mm-hmm. But then again, if it has a lot to do with Darren McFadden, it could have come from Gary Brown. Yeah. So, I mean, because there's so many different possibilities, and because, to be honest, the sample size is still small.
Yeah.
As far as what this is, and it's small enough to where it's like, if we'd have even got to see a half of Joseph Randall against the Giants before he got hurt,
we would know.
We would know the answer to this question. Absolutely. Because the thing is, what they've done with Kristen Michael, and it's basically been something like 50-50. I mean, he's got like 9 carries in the 2 games, but he's had, I don't know, 3 or 4 or 5 outside zone carries of those 9 carries. So it's rough to be able to know, okay, well, are they calling all the gap plays because it's McFadden, or are they calling it because that's the way they want to call it? If it's the way that they decided they want to call it, it came from either Frank Pollock or Scott Linehan, in my opinion. If it came because of who the running back is, it probably came from either Gary Brown or Scott Linehan.
I have to think, and just this is just me speculating, but I have to think that what the original decision probably was, okay, let's do what works for each of these guys, right? Like when Randall's in there, let's start running more outside zone. And when McFadden, and I'm talking about at the bye week, right? And then when McFadden's in there, let's start running more gap. And then after Randall gets hurt, it becomes, well, it's the McFadden show anyway, so might as well just call a whole bunch of gap power man stuff. So I wonder if that might have been the call. And then, you know, the early injury to Randall kind of just put the overall play to their strength strategy to bed, because they only had one guy to play the strengths to.
Yeah, because I mean, we have the numbers at some point in the year after week 4 or week 5, I can't remember what it was, and Bob Sturm's the guy who runs the numbers on this every week. Darren McFadden was like 80% of his carries were mm-hmm. outside zone carries on the season.
Uh-huh.
So that's 8 to 10 carries a game. So we're talking about 7 to 8 of those a game being outside zone. So it's very likely that you're absolutely right, that they said, okay, we're going to play to the strengths of these guys that we have. And they sat down with Gary Brown and said, okay, what do these guys do? What can we do with these guys? And they figured it out. And then when Randall got hurt, it went, well, heck, let's become a power gap team. And that's what they did. And away they've gone from there. And they've had some success with it. And we'll just have to see how sustainable that success is with the particular lead back that is the one carrying the ball that many times.
Well, great stuff as always, Joey. We really, really appreciate you coming by. Guys, make sure that you're following Joey if you aren't already. Make sure you see all his stuff on Cowboys HQ. He's still doing the Bleacher Report game day reporting, right?
I am. I have to go write one of those right now.
Yeah, and make sure you also follow him. He's an absolute must-follow. One of my favorite follows on Twitter, at Joey Ickes, at JoeyIckes. Joey, I would ask you to come back, but I'm pretty sure that you're contractually obligated to come back a couple of 100 more times in the next season. So
I wouldn't be surprised.
We'll definitely be back, and we can't wait to have you on again.
Thanks,
Joey. I appreciate
it,
guys. Thanks, guys.
Well, as always, it's awesome to have Joey on talking X's and O's. You know, I saw this as a unique opportunity to talk about sort of new developments, and indeed, Joey provided exactly what I was hoping he would.
Yeah, he's always really great, of course, and he gives us exactly what we want with X's and O's, and it's so concise, and that's really what really makes him great. Let's go ahead and get Tom in here, because we do need to also talk about the larger state of the Cowboys, I think, and Tom's a good guy to have for that. So let's bring him in real quick.
Okay, let's do that.
To welcome Blogging the Boys' own Tom Ryle to the show. Tom, welcome.
I'm so glad to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here too, sir. It's been a while, and Tom, as everyone knows, is the BTB-er formerly known as Piney Woods, and has been a Cowboys fan for many a year. His profile, by the way, notes, I quote, "I don't remember LeBaron, but I do remember Dandy Don hitting Bullet Bob in full stride," which I'm pretty sure is about 10 to 15 years before I was even born. And a prolific front page writer. He just passed his 1,500 postmark. Congratulations, Tom.
Oh, I did?
Yes, well, you did at Blogging the Boys since August 2011 when he joined. And in that time, he's penned a wide variety of great posts and has established himself as our resident evangelist for the Jason Garrett, Stephen Jones, Will McClay triumvirate. So, Tom, again, welcome aboard. And we'd like to start there. In the last couple of years, the Cowboys front office has conducted itself as a successful teams do, showing patience, sticking to a set of core beliefs, and maintaining a long view. Since the end of training camp, they have made a lot of roster moves that involve trading away draft picks. And when we combine those with the recent lineup shuffling, I wonder, are they anxious about Romo's closing window? And because of this, do their recent moves smack of desperation?
I would characterize it more as having to face reality in the face. That's kind of redundant, isn't it? They're having to look at the fact that Tony Romo, A, is not going to be around forever, and B, he can get hurt, as we found out to our dismay. Of course, the moves, some of the most recent things, you know, like what's been going on with signing Trey Williams, and before that, Kristen Michael. That was being driven partly by injury situations, and then, of course, the whole thing with Randall just going to pieces. It's just more reaction to things that are developing. I don't see them desperate. I see them as trying to do something to get this season back on track. before it goes completely off the rails down the side of the mountain and into the river at the bottom of the canyon. What are you going to do? Just sit there and go like, oh, well, we've lost Tony. Let's just stand pat and press ahead. No. I think they're doing what they're looking for the best answers they can with the resources they have. They haven't spent a lot on the moves they've made. You know, we're talking some sixth and seventh round draft choices. Mm-hmm. So it's not unreasonable given all they've had to deal with, I don't think. I do think that we saw that the plan kind of ran into some serious bumps. You know, obviously running back didn't work out the way they thought it would. Now they've had to deal with all of the injuries. It's just something you can't really plan for. So, some of their plans kind of haven't worked out the way they should, but they're trying their best right now.
Rab, what do you think?
Well, I would agree with Tom. I think that part of this does have to do with spending resources that are in some ways are extra resources because they know they're going to have a bunch of sixth and seventh rounders extra. Like they're going to have a bunch of compensatory picks. So I think if they didn't have those lined up, we might be able to question more what they're doing because they would basically just sit on their hands the whole third day of the draft. But they're still going to have some ammunition because of all those compensatories. So Tom, one of the aforementioned lineup changes happened, obviously, at quarterback, where Matt Cassel took over for Brandon Whedon. So after two games of Cassel's starting, admittedly small body of work, but what are your impressions of what he's done, and what has he provided, if anything, that Whedon didn't?
I think he does stretch the defenses out a little bit because they have to respect the fact that he'll throw the ball where Whedon really wouldn't. Unfortunately, sometimes that's been to the wrong jersey, as it was at several inopportune moments a couple of games ago. But I do think that he is just a more capable quarterback. He showed he could move the chains. Against the Giants, they didn't go three and out. And I think against Seattle, it was fairly late before they had a three and out, when they were beginning to flounder after they had failed repeatedly to get into the end zone. So he does offer that, I believe. Is he really going to be the answer? I don't know. But as I mentioned in an article, the Cowboys have been facing some really good quarterbacks of late. Mm. Now they get to go up against Sam Bradford, maybe things will finally start to balance out. You know, you don't want to give up any hope until they're mathematically eliminated. But I'm kind of hoping that Cassel may be able to get them a couple wins here. I'm not going to give up until they actually lose the games anyway.
So this is a sort of follow-up question about Matt Cassel. And this is something you and I share, this kind of pet theory, that the Cowboys actually – intended for Cassel to take over for Whedon during the bye from the moment they traded for him. So, we've talked about this, I think, in email exchanges. So, essentially that they once they realized Romo was going to be down for as long as he was, they realized that, Whedon, who's capable of coming in maybe for a game, was not going to be able to sustain for that 7-8 game stretch, and they needed something different. And they looked at the schedule and went, okay, if we get a guy now, we can train him for a couple weeks and then bring him in after the bye. So after 2 weeks of the Cassel era, do you still believe in this theory? Do you still believe this is the case?
Yeah, I think they were kind of like the guy who says, oh, it's going to be all right, and then everything goes wrong and it goes like, oh my God, what do I do now? I think that's kind of what hit them with the whole thing that they had in the back of their mind. As long as Romo's not out for too many games, Whedon can get us there. And then all of a sudden they're going like, he's going to be out for 7 games. Oh my God, have you been looking at Whedon in practice?
Right.
I don't know. I think Whedon may have been one of those guys that could go into practice and look pretty competent, but I think it began to dawn on them that when he was in a real game, it didn't work quite the same.
Hey, what's the opposite of a gamer? A practicer?
A workout warrior kind of guy. He's the equivalent of that. He goes in and practices really fine, and then he gets out there, and there are actual people in a different colored jersey trying to cause physical harm to him, and he just kind of comes unglued.
Well, yeah, it's tough to try to compare them because of the small body of work, but it does feel like that is probably exactly what happened, is that once they realized that, because then that kind of sums up, it kind of fits in with the way Whedon's played too. If you look at like Whedon when he comes in relief duty, he does a great job. Like he obviously had that game in Philly that he came in and was perfect, or at least, you know, 7 for 7 for like 130 yards and I think 2 touchdowns or 1 touchdown at least. And I think he does that okay. I think you're right when it's talking about being the guy for multiple weeks and game planning, and you know, I think ultimately it doesn't take people very long to figure out that Whedon doesn't have any touch. You know,
yeah, so. I think that's exactly what you can see through his arc when he went looked really good at the end of that Philadelphia game, and he just went downhill. And by the time they got to New England, who is so good anyway, they had their game plan down. It's basically like if the receiver's gone past about 7 yards, forget him.
Yeah,
he's not going to throw to him.
Yeah, so let's talk about the two other lineup changes. They both involve rookies. Lael Collins is now the starter at left guard, and Byron Jones looks to have taken the free safety job from J.J. Wilcox. So now that we are just shy of the halfway mark of the season, what is your assessment of the Cowboys' 2015 rookie class?
Really great in the top 2 plus 1, since Lael Collins was not a draftee. You throw in, Jones is just doing superbly out there. He's playing like a third or fourth year veteran from everything I've seen. Randy Gregory's been hurt. He's been slowed. I saw an article of that. I need to read it, but he's basically alluding to the fact that he feels like he's back physically, but he hasn't quite caught up mentally. He's still trying to get the game down because he was put behind by his injury. You throw them in and Lael Collins, and they've got 3 really solid rookies, and then we got the rest of the guys. Chaz Green, the mythological tackle. Damian Wilson looks like he's turning into a special teams guy right now, and that's about all they're getting out of him. Certainly not coming on the way Anthony Hitchens did as a rookie. Ryan Russell is, I think, inactive. He's on the roster. That's about it. I saw they just got I can't remember how to pronounce his name anymore, but Mark Nzocha is back in practice now.
Nzocha,
he's back in practice now. Mm-hmm. Of course, Lawrence Gibson is gone, and Jeff Swain is basically another placeholder for when Hannah can't go. They can throw him in the lineup. So, really strong, 3 really strong players out of the rookie class, and some other people that may never really contribute much, or we make it 1 or 2 to turn into decent roster mid-level type players.
Part of that might be an indictment of this year's rookie class in the second and third days, and part of that might be the fact that this roster is now so talented and deep that you have to be a pretty talented guy to crack it. Although, Landon, if you want to weigh in on this, the guy that disappoints me is Wilson, because there were times we saw him as a more sort of physical version of Hitchens during training camp. I really, really liked watching him run drills and play during camp. And it seemed like he was coming with a bullet. He actually sort of seemed at one point to have earned starter reps on the strong side. And I know you and I talked about the possibility that we might be seeing him as a starting strong side linebacker before long. And then something seems to have happened. Whether he regressed or he pissed the coaches off or something. And he really hasn't done much other than what Tom was saying, he's becoming a bit of he's a special teams regular, but he's not even a special teams standout yet.
Yeah, I think that, if you remember, there was definitely a point when we were trying to compare the trajectories between him and Hitchens in late in training camp. And I remember that, like, it got to a point where, oh, God, and I can't remember if it was run game or there was some flaw in his coverage or his inability to get off blocks, and I can't remember which of the two it was. But it was such a thing that it became apparent, and then it became obvious. And then suddenly it was like you didn't see him getting in on defensive snaps as with the ones and twos as often. And obviously I think, there's – I think a little bit of what you discussed earlier plays in. I mean, he is behind, you know, not only Hitchens, but also probably Wilbur, who are both guys who, you know, maybe aren't elite players, but both have skins on the wall and have made plays in the league. So they're not mm-hmm. exactly guys to step in front of. I think maybe where the issue is that we initially put him on this trajectory because he looked better than Anthony Hitchens did in training camp the previous season.
Right.
But I think what it was is that, you know, maybe Hitchens didn't look as good at training camp, but looked better in the regular season, whereas Wilson kind of did the opposite and maybe just needs a little bit more of a learning curve than Hitchens does.
Right. And you know, and there's no Cam Lawrence on this year's roster. So
yeah,
it's just tougher. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So Tom, that rookie class that we just talked about was one of the many reasons I thought, and I think Landon, you would agree with me, thought back in August that this was one of the deepest, most talented Cowboys rosters that I had seen in a long time, if not ever. So, you know, obviously because of this, I had really, really high hopes coming into the season. So, Tom, what were your expectations coming in? And if they were high, I guess, you know, the corollary question is, what the hell happened to our season?
Well, yeah, they were high. and basically, those two questions are so closely related because what happened to the season? Well, let's see. Back in training camp, we lost our top cornerback. Game one, we lost the top wide receiver. Game two, we lost the starting quarterback. Now, let's see. There are, what are they called? The five key positions. I can't remember the term for them.
Right.
The corner posts, the franchise corners or whatever.
I call them the positions of great import, and KD calls them the money five.
Money five. That's
yeah. And what are those positions? Quarterback, cornerback, wide receiver, left tackle, and your defensive end.
And don't forget about the fact that Randy Gregory was hurt and we didn't have a Greg Hardy there. So, yeah, they lost four of their five money five.
Yeah.
And, you know, keep praying to the gods that Tyron Smith stays healthy.
Hey, I think we just came up with a great post right there.
that's
exactly what happened to it. You take out four of your five most important positions. Yeah, you're going to have a hard time making up for that. And you can have depth, but almost nobody has depth at quarterback. We're finding out that Terrence Williams is a really good number two wide receiver.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily your lead wide receiver. Cornerback has been in good shape, though. We actually survived that pretty well.
Mm-hmm. So, well, you know, if you think about this, you know, if you think about the money five, you think, why are they the money five? And they're the money five because, you know, you can win with a mediocre play, defensive tackle, but where you have to have elite players who win matchups are on those particular positions, you know? And so those are the positions that literally make the difference between winning and losing. And when you lose four of the five, I mean, I don't know if I thought about it in such clear terms before, Tom, but when you lose four of the five, the fact that the Cowboys were good precisely because they had the best slot corner in the league and one of the better and probably the best cornerback in the division in Scandrick. They have the best quarterback in the division and one of the top three in football in Romo. They have one of the top two or three wide receivers in the game in Bryant. And you know, Gregory's just a rookie, but without Greg Hardy there, they didn't have arguably the best defensive end and one of the division and one of the best in the game. So those are, you know, money five guys who are actually game changing guys, which is why the Cowboys are so damn good. And none of them were there.
And on top of that as well, I think there's an X's and O element that people forget is that this offense specifically, I mean, it. And we can generally say this about most NFL offenses, obviously, but there are varying degrees. This offense specifically is centered on having a quarterback, an elite quarterback, and it has been you know, morphed and changed to kind of, you know, alleviate some of that from Tony's shoulders over the last few years. And obviously, they've leaned more on the run game, but. Let's be clear. All evidence that we've seen for the run game is that the run game comes through Tony Romo and Dez Bryant. And that if they don't have that ability to push people off, that the offensive line can block as, you know, as well as they can, but they can't, you know, multiply themselves. Eventually they're going to get outnumbered in the box, and you know, that's going to stop the run game. And if you already don't have a quarterback and you already don't have a wide receiver, and now you've taken away the run game as well, there is no strategy. There is no, I mean, you can have all the depth you want, but if you don't have the talent at the positions that are required for, in order for you to move the ball and score, then it completely saps all the strength of your depth. And
I want to tag on one thing that Gravel just said. Could somebody take Matt Castle and introduce him to Cole Beasley? Apparently Beasley's too short and Castle doesn't know who he is or something out there. Beasley is so good and so productive, and Castle can't hit him with a pass.
No, he just doesn't. It's really interesting. He doesn't see him or something. It's really interesting.
Maybe they're just covering Cole in the absence of the other receivers.
Well, they are definitely doing that before Dez got back. I mean, they, you know, on third downs, they were just doubling Witten and doubling Beasley. And, you know, that basically, I mean, Beasley, he's kind of Weasley. Beasley, you know, is good, and he can beat single coverage, you know, all day, every day. But, you know, he's not an elite physical athlete who's able to, you know, beat double teams. I mean, there's not enough space for him to get away. And so, well, and go ahead.
Maybe playing a team without Richard Sherman to take Dez Bryant out single-handedly, may change the equation this week.
And that's absolutely a chance, an opportunity. And if anybody is going to be scared of Dez Bryant, I think it probably could be the Philadelphia Eagles. So in the last couple of weeks, one of the debates about this year's Cowboys 2-5 team is whether they are bad. And this is kind of talking what we're just talking about. They were never as talented, i.e. they were never as talented as we thought them to be, or whether they have just been unlucky, injuries, bad breaks, lack of turnovers, or run of very good opposing quarterbacks. You know, kind of piggybacking on what we just discussed, where do you fall on this particular issue?
Well, the team that started the first game of the season was certainly not bad. They had some things that were still trying to come together, as we've discussed elsewhere on the site. It seems like maybe the drive to get everybody healthy for the first game led to them not being as ready to play as a unit as possible, particularly the offensive line. But that group that came in, if they'd have stayed healthy for a couple of weeks, I think the team would have been steamrolling people, at least all but a couple of the teams they've faced so far. So it's not that they're a bad team, and I don't know if you can say it's unlucky. It's such a confluence of things. A run of really good quarterbacks to face, you know, some pretty tough teams. Their strength of schedule of the people they've played right now, you know, they've had one of the tougher schedules coming in, you know, and they're trying to do it with a team that's largely patchwork at some very key positions. So, you know, it's just all kind of come together and been like the perfect storm to really screw the season up.
Okay, so following up, speaking of bad luck, one of the things Lady Luck brings to the table is questionable officiating. Indeed, the Cowboys have suffered from some very inopportune calls this season. I know you have a pet theory on officiating league-wide. Can you share it with us, and how much does that impact the Cowboys' season?
Well, it impacts, I think, all teams kind of at random. It's just the last game, it was the Cowboys' turn to really get smacked by it, kind of like it was in the game against Green Bay, where a really strange call went against them. But I think the league, it's kind of hard to put this really concisely, but the league has gotten so concerned about replay and trying to get it down to the millimeter and everything, that it's kind of become like where the legal system has gotten too picky. Everything is down to, you know, oh, you didn't dot that I, so, you know, that gets thrown out kind of thing. Common sense has gone out the window. I think the referees on the field are gun-shy. They don't want to be called out for making a bad call, and so they're actually trying so hard, and they're trying to apply such arcane rules and put them in. They're missing the obvious stuff, the whole thing of what is a catch. has become endemic. It seems like almost every game there's a call where everybody's going like, well, is that a catch or not? And nobody can be sure, and it kind of depends on who's calling it or what day it is, whether it is a catch or not. You see things like that. You know, there were three plays I saw that in the last game that really brought this out to me. And let me see if I can get them all right. Of course, the first one was the second timeout that they called that they shouldn't have been allowed, where the referees didn't know what to do in the case. Somebody called an illegal timeout. They stopped the clock. They should have let it run. The ball would have been snapped, 12 men on the field, penalty, and at least the Cowboys would have had three more chances to score a touchdown before Dan Bailey came out and kicked the field goal anyway. But it took away a chance for them. The others were a couple of things that just kind of still make me wonder. It's like, why are they seeing things so oddly? One was the hit Jeff Heath made on Lockett, where they call that and said it was a blindside hit. How do you hit somebody from the blind side when you hit them square in the chest almost?
Mm-hmm.
I really couldn't figure out why they were calling that. And it's interesting that nothing has come down about a fine on that. And I'm wondering if the league has looked at that and said, like, you know, that wasn't really a good call. How can we find the guy? Mm-hmm. Although I still don't know. I think they have a tendency to levy those fines anyway just because they don't want to admit they were wrong. And the other one that I can't figure out was the one that did get overturned and called correctly, and that was when they ruled Matt Cassel's incompletion a fumble. You look at it at regular speed, you look at it slow motion, he was throwing the ball, his arm got jarred, the ball came loose, but he completed the whole throwing motion and had an incomplete forward pass that just went out about 10 feet and sucked him to the ground. Why were they calling that a possible fumble? If you look, go back on NFL.com, they have all of the reviews that are overturned. You can go back and look at them. There is one of the officials staring it right, just looking straight at it, and he let that go. Come on, what, you know? Can't you see what it is? I think they have tried to refine the rule book. I think they need to go in and take a lot of these rules and simplify them down. You know, the pass thing, what is a reception? Go back to, you get the ball, you've got control of it, you get 2 feet down, it's a completion. Get rid of this whole going to the ground crap. You have to have evidence that he didn't have the ball controlled. Mm-hmm. But if he gets control, gets 2 feet down, it's now a catch, he's now a runner, go from there.
Ladies and gentlemen, Tom Ryle. So, Tom, you recently wrote a post, and it was entitled, Are the Cowboys Dead or Just Dying a Slow Death? This is, of course, the question on all of our minds these days. So which is it? Has the victim expired, or is it just going to be spending a long while in the ICU? Either way, I think we can agree the situation is critical. So I guess that leads us to this question. Is this game against Philadelphia the dreaded must win?
It's the closest to a must win that they've had, because if they lose to Philadelphia, they're at least two games back in the loss column. That would put them two games behind Philadelphia and possibly New York. And, you know, I think Washington's playing New England, and I would be absolutely gobsmacked if they managed to win that. But conceivably, they could be two games back behind anybody, and then it's going to be like, how do you catch up with all three of them? If they win this game, then they're basically going to be caught up with Philadelphia. Probably will be caught up with Washington, and then we'll have to see what happens with New York, but at least they're going to be keeping pace behind them. And then they've got a chance. So it's as close to a must win as they can have. There are still mathematically possible scenarios that could go on and win the division, even if they lose the game. But, man, the math is ugly looking when you look at that.
Mm.
So keeping all of those things in mind, with the season only half over, what gives you hope for the final 2 months?
Well, hope. I think they can win this game. Of course, I think they can win almost every game. But, you know, seriously, they're going up against Sam Bradford and an Eagles team that has a vulnerable secondary. You know, they still got what is being rated as the best defensive line in the league, especially with Collins in. You know, there were a couple articles that were floating around among the staff today about them being scored by PFF as the best O-line in football, and about there was a list of the top 10 most dominating blockers in the league. And guess what? Lael Collins, Tyron Smith, and Travis Frederick all made that list.
Huh. Which is odd, because if anybody belongs on that list, it's Zach Martin.
Yeah, you know? Which is kind of odd, but I believe I recall that correctly. I'm pretty sure they had.
Oh, I think you're right.
They had Collins. They had Collins because of, you know, he was pancaking. So he had the double pancake on one, and then I think it was membane.
The membane one was much more impressive. That was just insane. I've never seen anybody move membane like that before.
Yeah, put him on roller skates, 10 yards, and put him flat on his back.
That was crazy.
Yeah, that was awesome.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Tom, thanks so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge with us. I just want to remind everyone out there to follow Tom and his great consistent work on Blogging the Boys. And he's a great Twitter follow as well. His Twitter handle is at Tom Ryle BTB. That's at TOMRYLE, capital B, capital T, capital B. Tom, please come back and chat Cowboys again sometime soon, will you?
Hey, you got my number. Call me, guys.
All right, will do.
Well, another one in the book, Rabble, and this is actually our last Eagles podcast. I can't believe that we've already played the Eagles twice. It seems like this season has started to slip away from us.
I'm telling you.
So I guess, keeping that in mind, next week is going to be the halfway point of the season. So what do we have in mind for the midpoint extravaganza?
Well, we're going to have our midseason Cowboys at the Halfway Poll episode, as we do every year. But this time we're going to do something a little bit different. Instead of inviting a single luminary, we're actually going to join all the guys who are over at Cowboys HQ.
Ah.
So we're going to have KD and Joey again, and Keith Mullins in, and we'll have a little roundtable discussion of the season thus far. And this is actually a segment that's going to be broadcast on both KD's Crunch Time podcast and on ours. So it should be kind of an interesting little kind of dual platform deal.
Excellent.
And then we're also going to preview the upcoming opponent with JC De La Torre, who's over at Bucks Nation, which is the SB Nation Tampa Bay Buccaneers site. So it should be a good one.
Excellent. I'm looking forward to that. And before we go, of course, I have to again plug bloggingtheboys.com, who put on this fine podcast. Make sure you're checking out the site for all the information about the Cowboys this week. You know, Eagles coming in, so make sure you're checking the comments. They're always colorful, to say the least. Make sure you check out the Facebook page, Blogging the Boys, and on Twitter, at Blogging the Boys. And until next week, go Cowboys, screw the Eagles, and happy trails.
Happy trails, y'all.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until then. Who cares about the clouds when we're